On Sunday, March 20th at 11 p.m., Sugar My Bowl continues its celebration of Women's History Month with Chris Becker, the author of Freedom of Expression, interviews with women in jazz, and the NEA director of music and opera, Ann Meyer Baker. We discuss the web stream of the NEA Jazz Master Musical event and 50 years of the National Endowment for the Arts. That's Sunday, March 20th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
Sweetness down in my soul. I could stand some loving, oh, so bad. I feel so funny, I feel so sad. I want a little steam on my clothes. Things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I need some sugar in my bowl. I ain't
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is the author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, Chris Becker. We are going to start off the program, however, with a conversation with the NEA Director of Music and Opera, Ann Meyer Baker. And she's going to talk to us about the 50th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Arts and the April 4th web stream that's going to happen of the Jazzmaster event. But we're going to start off the program with a selection from former Sugar guest Brandi Younger's latest release. Her release is titled Wax and Wane, and the selection is called Essence of Ruby. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web, Sugar in my bowl coming up.
I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar in my bowl.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Ann Meyer Baker.
Ann Meyer Baker, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. Ann Meyer Baker is presently the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, Director of Music and Opera. And I have here that you are coming from a Chorus America, which is an advocacy, research, and leadership development organization that apparently serves and supports choral conductors, administrators, board members, and singers. And that company is headquartered in D.C. as well. In what way did that help you in your present position at the NEA?
Well, my beginnings in music started way back, so it's very much in my DNA. I was raised by a public school music teacher who taught for 47 years.
Wow.
I was the youngest of five children, and we were all five required to take piano lessons, study another instrument, play in the orchestra and the band, and sing in the choir, and. So it all began early for me, and I started my career actually as a public school music teacher, just like my mother, and then got a job as a professional singer. And since then, always worked for national arts organizations in different disciplines. I worked for the League of American Orchestras, for example. I worked for a music education association, and then most recently, for 15 years, ran Chorus America, which is the association for choruses. So I've worked in a lot of different kinds of arts organizations, and I think and hope that they are all informing my work at the National Endowment for the Arts.
I also understand that jazz, you weren't so familiar with that. Do you still feel like you're learning about the music these days?
Well, I feel like I'm always learning. Right. You know, it's I hope that
right.
I'm always learning until I drop.
Right.
But, you know, I love jazz, and I had a kind of fun window into it early on. My dream growing up was to be singing in a dark, smoky bar for the rest of my life.
Wow.
So I love the music. But the last couple decades of my career have been focused more on classical music. So I've sort of gotten away from it. But early on in my life, I encountered a wonderful fellow named Joel Siegel, who was for a while the manager for Shirley Horn, and he produced a bunch of other singers' albums. And he was my upstairs neighbor, and he was wonderful and smart and interesting. But I grew up in the Midwest, and so my Midwestern nice gene kind of got in the way of his grumpy gene, and I might never have been his friend, but my husband befriended him immediately. So a lot of really great jazz artists set up camp in our apartment because we were his overflow room.
Oh.
And they, you know, they would play and sing, and so I had a wonderful look into the jazz scene personally in my home for many, many years, and that was just great fun. So still learning, but have a lot of experience from my past too. He was also a theater critic, and he won a Grammy Award for liner notes for Billie Holiday on Verve, and he just did a lot of things.
Nice. The Jazz Masters. Tell me, what is your role with regard to the NEA Jazz Masters?
So I oversee the Jazz Masters initiative. My portfolio is really wonderful and broad. So under music comes jazz and world music, orchestral music, choral music, chamber music, new music, and opera. So it's a really broad portfolio. And in the area of jazz, of course, we make grants to jazz-related organizations. And over the last decade or so, more than $30 million have been invested by the National Endowment for the Arts in jazz-related projects. But in addition to our investment in jazz projects, we do the Jazz Masters program. So since 1982, we have selected each year a handful of jazz greats, and we recognize them with this honorific. And when you become an NEA Jazz Master, you receive a cash award of $25,000, and then we do a whole bunch of things to communicate the value that you have invested in the world of jazz. So we do a concert where we celebrate the Jazz Masters. We do a bunch of podcasts and interviews and videos and all kinds of things to collect information about their contributions and to celebrate those contributions. So the concert is right around the corner, and it's all jazz all the time on my desk.
There's also an educational component in some of the activities that involves the Jazz Masters as well?
Exactly. This year we've expanded some of our activities to leverage all the great things that the Jazz Masters have done. So, for example, this year we're doing a listening party at National Public Radio Studios here in Washington, where Jason Moran, who is the artistic director for jazz at the Kennedy Center, will be doing some interviews, chatting with the Jazz Masters, listening to their music, having them share some insights into that. In addition, there are a bunch of free concerts on what the Kennedy Center calls Millennium Stage that will be happening around our events with both young jazz players and veterans. And we're taking the Jazz Masters to the Duke Ellington School for the Performing Arts in Washington, where they'll work with student jazz folks and, you know, give them some coaching. So that should be really exciting for the kids.
Oh, that's wonderful. What is the process of nominating and selecting Jazz Masters?
We accept nominations for Jazz Masters 365 days a year. Any day you can go on our website, and members of the general public, certainly members of the jazz community, we seek out and invite them to to make nominations. And then once a year, on December 31st, we gather up all of those nominations and we share them with a group of experts that we assemble as a selection panel. It's an advisory group that sorts through the hundreds of nominations that we have and makes their recommendation of who should be honored in the coming year. And those recommendations then go to the National Council for the Arts and ultimately to our chairman, Jane Chu, who makes the final decision.
And this year, well, you have some major favorites of mine who have been honored or who will be honored, one of them being Farrell Sanders.
Absolutely.
The saxophonist, major great saxophonist. Another saxophonist, Archie Shepp. Gary Burton. Oh, I love Gary Burton. Gary Burton.
Me too.
And Wendy Oxenhorn. Do I have her name correctly? She's
you
with
do.
The Jazz Foundation.
Exactly. Let me
yes.
tell you about that, because each year we choose one person who has contributed to the field as a jazz advocate. Mm-hmm. So sometimes those advocates are people who have been educators or journalists. But in this case, we chose Wendy Oxenhorn, and she is the president of the Jazz Foundation for America. And the Jazz Foundation has a really important mission, which is to look after jazz artists who sometimes are not highly paid or highly recognized, can be overlooked. Maybe they didn't have health insurance or whatever it might be when they were coming up playing until the wee hours of the morning and managing their own careers. So sometimes those jazz masters fall on hard times. And the Jazz Foundation of America helps them by providing health care or getting them some gigs playing in schools or looking after them if they need some legal assistance, all kinds of things. And Wendy has just been the driving force behind that.
Oh, yeah. Wendy's great. Wendy's also a musician. I saw her at the local 802, the Musicians Union here in New York, and she was just getting down on a harmonica.
Yeah, she's a mean harmonica player, that's for sure.
So tell me about the stream that's going to happen of the Jazz Masters event on the 4th.
So this year, the Jazz Masters for the last couple years have been celebrated in New York at Jazz at Lincoln Center, and we have a great relationship with them that is ongoing. This year we wanted to bring the concert to Washington because it's the 50th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Arts, and we're sort of celebrating in our hometown and trying to co-locate as many of the things that we can to Washington for this special year. So this year we're collaborating with the Kennedy Center on the Jazz Masters, and we'll be in the concert hall in the Kennedy Center at 8 p.m. on April the 4th. But that hall holds 2,200 people, which is terrific. And in fact, all those tickets have already been gobbled up. But, you know, people don't always show, and we're sure that we'll be able to accommodate people at the last minute. So what do you do to extend beyond the 2,200 lucky people who get to be there live? We are live webcasting, video streaming at arts.gov and at kennedycenter.org and at npr.org. So you can watch it live at home, or you can listen to it live. It will be on radio, on Sirius XM, on Real Jazz. So there are opportunities to take advantage of it, even if you can't make yourself available to come to Washington and be in the concert hall.
Yeah, and I noticed that the performances will feature NEA Jazz Masters Randy Weston, one of our major favorites, Jimmy Heath, as well as Ambrose Akinmazuri, Lakeisha Benjamin, who's been a guest on our program, Stefan Harris, Justin Coughlin, Rudresh Mahanthapa, Jason Moran, who you mentioned, who's affiliated with the Kennedy Center, Linda Oh, and Roswell Rudd. Oh, we love him too.
I know, it's a great lineup, but I have to tell you, we have some secrets. And we haven't shared all of them yet, so watch this space, because we have a couple more really wonderful musicians who will be joining us as well. We'll leak that news soon.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I have really appreciated this chat. Is there something that you want to share with regard to the 50th anniversary of the NEA, National Endowment for the Arts, or how it's being observed this year, or anything else that I may not have mentioned?
Sure. So we're spending the whole year celebrating our 50th anniversary, which is sort of like what I did when I turned 52. I spent a whole year celebrating. As part of the anniversary, there are a number of events and things that we're trying to do to sort of bring the general public to more knowledge about what the National Endowment for the Arts is, what it does, why it matters, and most of all, to just encourage people to participate. You know, I was asked the other day, what what can we do to help support the National Endowment for the Arts? And I said, support the arts. Like, get off your sofa, go hear a concert, go to the museum, you know, do something to participate, because there's a way in for everybody, and we really want the arts in this country to be something that everybody takes advantage of, not just the privileged few.
Right. Now, is there a sort of ongoing calendar that's being kept of the festivities for this 50th anniversary?
There is, and also we have a special NEA 50th anniversary website, and you can go just go to our website and look. It's impossible to miss. And there are a bunch of really cool facts, and my favorite thing on that website is actually a timeline, and you can kind of walk through big highlights of things in the arts over the history of the NEA. So I recommend a trip to the NEA website and a look at some of the facts that are there that are just really impressive.
Yes, and that is www.arts.gov, arts.gov. And as a matter of fact, if you just love typing and you want to put slash 50th, 50th, then that'll take you to the timeline of which you had mentioned and the other specifically related 50th anniversary items. So
perfect.
That is wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And Meyer Baker, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl and sharing this information about the streaming webcast for April 4th and also the 50th anniversary of the National Endowment for the Arts. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Have a good night.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Song in me. Life is a song.
Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Chris Becker.
Chris Becker, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. The reason why we're talking to Mr. Chris Becker in Women's History Month, because Chris Becker wrote a book, Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, and was just released late last year.
Yeah, November is when I put it out.
So thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
The first thing I want to mention is your partner, your wife, Lainey Diamond. She's primarily a European classical vocalist. She's also the founder. He's like, yeah, why are you talking about my wife?
No, I'm delighted.
Because we're talking about all these other women, I thought I'd at least start with your partner. She's also the founder and creator of Houston Laughter Yoga. And
absolutely.
Was it We Have Laughter?
Houston, We Have Laughter is the catchphrase I came up with for Houston Laughter Yoga. Since we landed in Houston, Texas, and of course, you know, we're near the NASA and all that stuff. But yeah, she is a vocalist. She's in New York for years. She sang with professional choral groups at Lincoln Center. She sang for a time at St. Patrick's as a cantor, and also sang music by music composed by friends of mine. You know, things that kind of crossed over between jazz and contemporary classical music. So she's very, you know, got a very wide range as a mezzo. But here in Houston, she's applied those talents with the voice to laughter yoga, which is essentially yogic breathing, but it's done with laughter. So you have people laughing, and what that does is it tricks your body into breathing from your diaphragm, which has all kinds of health benefits. She works with a lot of different communities, too. Folks like you or me who might take a class at the library, but she also works with mentally and physically challenged adults, people with Alzheimer's and dementia, persons living with AIDS, and she's seen some incredible things taking them through these exercises that may sound silly, but they have a profound effect on your body. And any singer will tell you how important it is to breathe and breathe correctly, right? So that's been kind of a wonderful new adventure for her since we've relocated from New York to Texas.
Now, that is a weekly public group, and it's presented by the Houston Public Library. Is that correct?
Well, she works with a lot of different organizations. You know, she works with the library. She works with a place called The Center, which is a place for mentally and physically challenged adults. And she works with the VA hospital here in town.
Oh, wow.
She works with veterans. So she moves in a lot of different circles and audiences and communities, you know.
And I understand that Lainey Diamond's voice was featured in, let's see, there's a film by Jill, what is it, Guion?
Guion. G-U-I-O-N. Yeah,
right.
Jill Guion. Yeah. We collaborated long distance to create a soundtrack for one of Jill's films, and which premiered at the Lincoln Center Dance on Camera Film Festival back in 2014, if I have that right. And since then, has gone on to win a lot of awards, and it keeps getting shown at different festivals. It's really exciting, and it's really wonderful to stay in touch with our New York people. We spent a long time in New York, and we had so many wonderful transformative experiences there. And there are ways you can keep in touch with people across the country now, across the world, right, as a musician and an artist. So it's been wonderful to be able to do that.
As a matter of fact, our paths crossed at the Brecht Forum.
I remember that was a great talk. I remember that. It was the economics and the independent musician something. So that, I don't know if that was the exact title, but it was a great panel discussion. I just don't hear that being discussed with that much frankness and honesty and really, you know, people caring about each other, you know, people looking out for each other. And the Brecht Forum and the musical communities, I've been connected through some of the folks there, people like Jeremiah Hosea and Lene Harris, who's interviewed in my book, the cellist. I remember she was there that night in the audience as well, and Lene's a good friend. That's my community. You know, those are some of the folks I really miss now that I'm here in Houston, but there are great people in Houston, too.
Sure. So. And essentially, I'd like to thank Claudia Copeland for introducing us. So there you have it.
Thank you, Claudia.
You're the one who made my dreams come true. A few kisses ago, I remember you. You're the one who said I love you too. I do, didn't life is through. And the angels ask me to recall the thrill of them all. Then I shall tell them I remember you.
In mentioning your working with Lainey on the film score, Widow was the name of the film.
Yes.
Tell me about yourself. What motivated you to write this book?
In Houston, for a time, I was a columnist for an online magazine called Culture Map Houston. And in my capacity there as columnist, I got to interview a lot of musicians who are coming to Houston to play gigs. Local musicians, but mainly a lot of national touring people. I was contacted by the tour manager of a saxophonist named Mindy Abair. Mindy is interviewed in the book. When I got the press release from the tour manager, I didn't know who Mindy was. And one of the things that was at the top of the press release was Mindy had just been on American Idol, you know, knocked everybody out. And so my first reaction was, well, I don't watch American Idol. I write about serious music. You know, I had a very negative kind of, you know, ignorant reaction to this, you know. But the more I then just kind of explored her background, I discovered that she also had, before American Idol, she had toured with the great Bobby Lyle, the pianist Bobby Lyle, who is now here in Houston. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then I learned more and more that her background actually involved a lot of serious study of jazz, as well as, you know, exploring the world of contemporary music, pop music, so-called smooth jazz, and that she's navigated these worlds with a lot of grace and success and intelligence. She's a strong advocate for musicians' rights. And I thought, I need to speak to this person. So it was kind of me looking at a person, and in this case, a woman with a saxophone, in a very one-dimensional way, and then realizing, wait, there's a lot I don't know about this person. I was very quick to judge this musician. I care about musicians, like the day-to-day struggle, the day-to-day challenges that we face to make music, the sacrifices one makes to become a great artist aren't an abstraction to me. You mentioned my wife, Lainey. She's a classical singer. This is her job, right? So talking with Mindy and then later talking to her tour manager, somehow it came up that collecting interviews specifically with women who play jazz in all of its forms, might be something really interesting and enjoyable to write about. And there are very few books about this topic. Mindy's tour manager then connected me to Terry Lynn Carrington and Eliani Elias. So I had some real heavy players like who I spoke to, told them I was writing this book, introduced myself, and they were very gracious with their time and gave, you know, wonderful, serious interviews about their music making. And from there, I was able to approach other musicians and say, well, this book includes Terry Lynn Carrington. Would you like to be a part of it? Or, and so that kind of opened some doors. And from there, we ended up, or I ended up interviewing a total of 37 women for this book, of all ages, all, as you know, playing just about every style of jazz you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully it's an engaging, comprehensive look at this music, you know, we call jazz, and where it's been and where it may be going.
Well, you mentioned Mindy Abaire, and there's actually, you have two entries in the book.
Yes.
On her. What is the difference between the two?
If you read the book from page one to the end, you know, it's 320 pages,
mm-hmm.
there's a method there. Which interview follows the next, which then comes next, etc.
Right.
I put a lot of thought into that, and Mindy's second interviewer, the part two, acts for me as kind of a coda after an interview, a wonderful interview with trumpeter Ellen Seeling.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I discovered, and I was naive about when I went into this, I found very interesting, was that the perception of gender discrimination and gender politics is very different depending on whether you're like in your 20s or in your 50s or 60s, because I was lucky enough to speak to people who remember the United States of America before the women's rights movement,
mm-hmm.
you know, before civil rights movement. So it's not so much that the younger generation takes things for granted, but there's a different perspective there. The same question gets a different response.
Right.
Ellen's interview, which is the next to last in the book, to me is the one that really, really digs into the tragedy that is gender discrimination in music, that it does impact musicians in a very profound way. It goes beyond just giving up playing, but can even lead to even worse consequences. And the entirety of her interview is really about her journey as a musician and, and what she went through to become a trumpet player, which is pretty unbelievable. But I felt like Mindy's, the excerpt that I have at the end of the book, was kind of the coda after a very intense interview, a very comprehensive and powerful and maybe challenging conversation.
Yeah, you mentioned Ellen Seeling, and there's one of the things that she created. She founded a girls' jazz and blues camp?
Yeah, exactly. Well, she has a couple of camps. One is for young women learning to play jazz and blues, and then the other camp is for adult women playing jazz. But she's also formed an advocacy group as well. That's an organized advocacy group for the rights of women, specifically women musicians, and gained a lot of attention last year for challenging Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and their hiring practices.
Great.
And there were protests out in the street. They have met with Jazz at Lincoln Center, and some changes have been made since then, since they've been making noise and working with legal people who know how to navigate these worlds. And some changes are being made, too, in the way that it's going to be hiring folks for that particular orchestra. So one of the many things I love about Ellen is she points out the problem, and then she's doing something about it.
Right.
You know, I like people who do that. That's one thing we gripe, and it's one reason I self-published the book. It's like, well, I could spend 2 or 3 years griping about, oh, you know, university presses aren't taking me seriously, or I mailed in and got a rejection letter. I was like, no, you know, my thing is like, do it yourself. Figure out how to do it yourself and put it out there on your own. That's the tradition I come from. So.
Well, now that you raised it, I was going to wait until much later to discuss how you went about deciding to self-publish with this particular outlet. I know a couple of other people who've considered CreateSpace.
Yeah.
How did you decide to go that route?
Well, there's a few, at least a few companies out there that are publishing books. Like anybody who can like put together a PDF now can publish a book, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, kind of their pluses and minuses.
Exactly.
And that was friends of mine who are published, particularly people in academia,
mm-hmm.
which I am not. I'm not a teacher. I'm not with a university. The argument against this was, well, you're going to be in that lot with the folks who publish, you know, whatever, the Fan, Erotica, or, you know, what, you know, just garbage, right? But again, I go back to the era of DIY, you know, the punk rock era,
mm-hmm.
and before that, taking inspiration from people like Amiri Baraka,
yes.
and just like do it yourself, you
right.
know, put it together yourself, staple it together, you know.
Right.
And I just thought, well, you know, if I can do this, but I got to make sure it looks great, and I also got to make sure it's copy edited really thoroughly. So the majority of our work was really had to do with copy editing and design of this book, you know, to make sure that when somebody looked at it, they didn't think, ah, it's a self-published book, you know.
Right.
You know, they think, wow, this is beautiful. You know, I want this on my shelf. I want to look at this. But CreateSpace was just, I talked to a couple of musicians who have published good books. One actually who published a lot of method books about Cuban piano styles, and another a pianist who had published an autobiography. And both of them were really happy with this particular company. And so that's why I went with them. Just, I did my homework. And for me, CreateSpace has been working really well. But I'm sure there are other companies out there that do really great work as well.
Together.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. What you're listening to right now is the title selection, Berber Taxi, from Malika Zara. Before that, we heard a live version of Wild Heart from Live in Seattle. That's Mindy Abair and the Bone Shakers. Yeah, I took a slight detour and played a couple of selections from people who haven't been sugar guests as of yet, but I think you should hear them. I only regret that I'm not able to squeeze in some Connie Crothers, and that is the woman who's on the cover of Freedom of Expression. And before that, we heard the title track of I Remember You by Diane Shore. Before that, we heard Life is a Song from Carmen Lundy's last year release, Soul to Soul. And before that, we heard Essence of Ruby, as stated earlier, by Brandi Younger from Wax and Wayne. And we opened the program with our queen, Nina Simone, and her version of I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl.
You have a rather international lot of women as well. One in particular I'm thinking of, Malika Zara from Morocco. In general, how did you decide that you were going to approach people? It's like, oh, I've got Terry Lynn Carrington on board. Are you interested? How did you come up with a list?
Yeah, at some point into the project, about maybe 1 or 2 years into the project, a professor friend of mine hit me to the fact that he said, you know what you're doing is called quantitative research. And what he meant was I'm interviewing a group of people who kind of fall into like a general category, asking them or beginning each interview with more or less the same questions,
right,
just the first few, perhaps, you know, when did you begin playing music? And then drawing from that recurring themes or things that I think that sort of define where the music is and where it may be going and where it's been. Again, I went into this process a little naive, just thinking, I just got to get some names in this. And then I have friends of mine who play music, so I'm like, hey, you want to be in my book? There wasn't that much thought initially other than I want to talk to people. But once I started realizing that I was interviewing people with very different backgrounds of different ages who played very different styles of jazz, I thought, okay, I really need to be aware of that as I continue with this and as I approach people. So honestly, I looked at, well, what's missing? You know, have I talked to somebody in this world? We talked about my friend Michael Veal, also another friend of mine, Flip Barnes, who plays with William Parker. Flip knew who I had interviewed, and he said, here are four women that I think you might want to contact, because he saw that there was some music that wasn't being represented in the collection of interviewees that I had had so far. And one of those women that Flip connected me to is the great Connie Crothers, who is on the cover of the book, who I was unaware of. I didn't know Connie's music. She's a very important figure in music, period, and she was delighted to be asked to be a part of the book. Malika, it's kind of like when I realized that what jazz is now, it always has been this, but I think especially now, the global influences on this music and the new hybrids that we're seeing, and I would contend that they are new. You'll run into musicians who say, ah, everything's been done already. And I feel like, well, if you're a new human being, if you play something, it's new, first of all, it's yours. But what I'm hearing are just these wonderful, really new forms of music that incorporate maybe the music of somebody's heritage, you know, where they grew up, their country, as well as what music they were stimulated by. Anat Cohen's an interesting example.
And that's exactly who I was thinking
about.
Yeah,
exactly. He's from Israel, who loves South American music, but can also, like, just shred Artie Shaw's Nightmare. You know, I mean, what do you say about that? It's like, that's kind of different.
I think her most recent release embraces her interest in Brazilian music.
Yeah, absolutely. But you've also got, like, a Flying Lotus arrangement on there, right? You know, with her group playing one of his. So that was sort of one of the threads that I wanted to grab onto and illuminate with the book in the introduction, saying, well, what is going on with jazz now, and what do I, from my perspective, see is being led, especially by women, in this music? And this is one of the things I talk about. And Malika's interview was a wonderful conversation for many reasons. Plus, I got to call Morocco, which was a trip. You know? I never do that.
And now you have a reason to do it again.
Yeah.
What you're listening to right now is a brief selection from Maz Swift, Tamika Reed, and Sylvia Molinesi from Here and Now. The name of this selection is Improv 1. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer Hank Williams, a ticket giveaway for the Schaumburg Women in Jazz Festival, and more Chris Becker, the author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz, on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Stay tuned.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for March 20th. This segment features aerial listings of Shug and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's guest is writer Chris Becker, author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews of Women in Jazz. He's not in the New York City area anytime soon, but we'll let you know when he comes by. And we have lots more music for you this week, including ticket giveaways for two Mondays at the Schaumburg Center's Women's History Month Jazz Concerts on the 21st and the 28th. Stay tuned for details and get your pens and pencils ready to copy down the info. First, we start with pianist Vijay Iyer, who has a residency at the Met Museum's new Breuer Building, that's the former Whitney Museum, until the 31st, and will be performing or curating performances during all of the museum's open hours. Saxophonist Lakeisha Benjamin is at the Schaumburg Center for the Women's History Month Jazz Program on the 21st, and Toshi Regan wraps up the series on the 28th. We have a pair of tickets to each performance. Email us at sugarinmybowl@gmail.com for a chance to win. That's sugar, spelled S-U-G-A, in my bowl at gmail.com, and we'll let you know if you're the winner. Be sure that you give us your contact info, including your phone number, in case we need to get a hold of you, and let us know which performance you prefer, the 21st or the 28th, and good luck. Also at the Schaumburg Center is film director Carol Bash for a daytime talk and screening of the Mary Lou Williams documentary film, The Lady Who Swings the Band, and that's on the 23rd. Bassist Mimi Jones leads a band at Smoke from the 23rd to the 24th. Also at Smoke is saxophonist Billy Harper, who finishes off the week with the Cookers from the 25th through the 27th. Arts for Arts Justice's Compassion Festival runs from the 26th to April 10th at Clemente Soto Vela's Center, with bassist William Parker and dancer Patricia Nicholson Parker among the performers there. Poet Sonia Sanchez reads at the City College of New York's Aaron Davis Hall on the 31st, before a screening of the documentary film Bad Sonia Sanchez. Pianist Randy Weston is at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on the 31st for a celebration of the African drum tradition. Blues vocalist Alexis P. Souter is at Iridium on the 31st, the Turning Point in Piermont, New York on April 9th, and the Record Collector in Bordentown, New Jersey on April 16th. Saxophonist Ravi Coltrane is at the Jazz Standard from March 29th to April 3rd. saxophonist Kenny Garrett is at Western Connecticut State University on April 2nd. Saxophonist Pharoah Sanders is at Birdland from April 5th through the 9th. And pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at the Village Vanguard from April 5th through the 10th. Organist John Medeski is at the Blue Note from April 5th through the 10th with John Schofield's band. Organist Dr. Lonnie Smith leads his Evolution Ensemble in a CD release party at Brooklyn Bowl on April 6th. Finally, saxophonist Oliver Lake is at Montclair Public Library on April 9th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on our website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, April 3rd. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Actually, the introduction is something I did talk to you about it earlier.
Correct.
That I found it impressive, actually.
Thank you.
It was very detailed and concise at the same time, and you told the story behind the creation of the birth of jazz, definition of jazz. I'm wondering, have you been challenged by any of the things you had written in that section?
Not yet, and I keep waiting for that.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think when I do get some serious challenges, and we'll know the book is reaching an even larger audience,
yeah.
You know, and I think honestly that might just be part of it, because people love to, jazz is, that world can be very contentious, you
yeah.
know, and people are very passionate about this word, you know, what
yes.
this word means, who
yes.
owns this word, you
right.
know, and I like the conversation, and this question, what is jazz, repeatedly in these interviews, you
right.
have musicians saying, "What? Well, I don't really use that word, you know, or,
right.
or, well, what does that even mean, you know, and, but it's also a wonderful way to kind of open the door to a discussion of music, and I think that instead of being proprietary about it, it's more interesting for me to open it up and say, well, if we're not going to use this word, what are we actually talking about? How do you describe this music? How is it not Cohen's music different than what Connie Crothers does when she sits at the piano? And all of a sudden, this word that a lot of people bring a certain amount of baggage to explodes and becomes something much more complicated and much more rich and enjoyable. I don't mean complicated in that you can't understand it, but complicated in that it is able to embrace so many different things, so many different worlds and perspectives. But I was told to create an introduction that was challenging and that did throw down. It was suggested to me, let's put it that way. And I thought that made a lot of sense. Again, it was like, great, you're interviewing all these different people, but what's the conclusions you're coming to? What are they saying? What do people need to take away from this? And that's what I tried to do in the introduction, and do it in a language, and this is how I write anyway, that anybody can open it up and read. You know, you don't have to even know, you don't even have to own a jazz record to open this book up and start to understand. When I copy edited this, I worked with two people who are not musicians, and that helped out a lot because because if I wrote something that they just didn't understand, you know, I'd get a note saying, Chris, you egghead, what does this mean? You know, like, you know, you're going to have to source that, man, you know? Okay. So, and that works. You know, we didn't dumb it down, but we made this a book for the musicians, but it's also a book for the people who are casually acquainted with this music.
Right. Actually, that is what I like. This book reads very nicely for anyone. Actually, what I like about it is the series of interviews. I mean, I like a lot of things about this book, but the fact that it is a collective of voices of people speaking in their own voice, which is what Sugar in My Bowl is all about, generally.
Yeah.
So I just enjoyed the way they come together and the fact that there was indeed a thread.
Yes.
So it was good to know that you did that consciously.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, capturing those voices, they were recorded, right? Mm-hmm. You know, just like we're doing now.
Right.
And that's a big challenge, is to put that down on paper.
Right.
Not only, like, you have to edit just for clarity,
sure. But
you also don't want to lose what uniquely characterizes a voice. So throughout the book, I hope that you hear the person's voice in your head. When we were copy editing it, I would explain to my editors, this presents a very heavy Portuguese accent, you know, like try and give them some idea of what the voice sounded like, you know, and we incorporate things like laughter, ellipses, things like that. But again, that's another challenge. I think I was a bit naive about how difficult that would be, but I really enjoy that. That is one thing I really truly enjoy, and I know the interviewees appreciated this. We ran every transcript by each interviewee, which is unusual, and added a lot more work to this project then. But that was really helpful because the interviewees could say, hey, can you just take out what I said about blah, 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 you know, or wait a minute, I realize I didn't clarify this, you know, just little things here and there, just so they went away from this and said, yes, I'm comfortable with this. This is my voice. You got it. You know, so let's put it out there.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
People are basically vehicles to just create money, which must create more money to keep the whole thing from falling apart, which is what's happening. There is no profit under the current paradigm. In saving lives, putting balance on this planet, having justice and peace or anything else. You have to create problems to create profit.
still spend about an hour a day trying to study this economy. And I'm not running for anything. I don't have a political agenda. I tried to figure out what.
The amount of deprivation in our world still remains unacceptable. Half of our fellow human beings live on less than $2 a day. That's simply not acceptable in a civilized world.
That we address the irresponsibility and recklessness that got us into this mess in the first place.
Actually, let me go way back to the title of the book. I noticed that it's referenced Trump, well, Terry Lynn Carrington quoting Duke Ellington. Jazz is freedom of expression. What did that do for you, having heard that and then deciding to title the book that?
The title came later. Initially, when I was approaching musicians, I told them I was calling it Women in Jazz. I'm laughing now because, first of all, the title, I'm like, well, you can do better than that. And the other thing was, what I did find and what I write about in the introduction, as you know, is that that title did rub some of the musicians the wrong way. You know, I'm a musician. You know, I don't want to be in. Now, not everybody was like this, but I understood this. Or to the best of my ability as a man, I'll say I understood this. It's like, I don't want to be in yet another project that's women in this or women doing this. You know, I've worked my whole life to not have to be branded in that way. Later on, feeling that the title was a little lacking, I had a long conversation. Actually, it was with Michael Veal, you know, and he thanked in the introduction.
Yes.
And we talked about titles. And over the course of that conversation, I think we came out with freedoms of expression, and I lobbed off the S and we got that. But again, the book is kind of like, I call it a Jedi mind trick, where at the end of the book, you're not necessarily thinking about women in jazz. You're thinking about musicians. And you're not maybe even thinking about jazz. You're thinking about freedom of expression. That's kind of the game I'm playing there. As a writer, I need words like jazz. You know,
you're
like, look, I got it. You notice I use the term this music quite a bit. And
yes.
I love that. And that comes from Amiri Baraka and which I love.
Right.
But I'm also not, you know, like, you know, this word needs to be destroyed. You know, I don't feel that way.
Right.
Personally, I don't feel that way. Well, freedom of expression, I can't imagine it being any other title. And even the colors of the cover of the book, those were suggested to me by Lainey. We sat down and we had photographs, and I knew I wanted the image of a musician as if being seen through a stained glass window. We'd been looking at Matisse's, the chapel that he designed, and his beautiful stained glass images. So Lainey, being the fashion conscious, the intelligent person between the two of us, and in those colors and those makeup and those, you know, it's a, she picked, you know, turquoise, gold, and the rose color that's in there. And then once we got this wonderful photograph of Connie Crothers at the piano for the cover, tinted in gold. And it's like, you know, as soon as we saw that, you know, even the designers, her daughter, who's like 14 or 15, said, that's it. You know, like she, you know, like, like everybody's like, that's the cover. So it's kind of wonderful how all these things come together, words and color and a photograph and all of that. And all these issues we're talking about, all these subtexts or whatever that we're talking and discussing here.
There's one thing I'm curious about you. What is your relation to music?
I studied piano and music theory and composition back in college at a school called Capital University in Columbus, Ohio. The unusual thing about that is the composition program at the time I enrolled was brand new, or rather they hadn't had a composition major in like 15 years, something like that. It was a very kind of old school sort of conservatory with a brand new composition teacher and director of the theory and composition department, a gentleman named Dr. Rocky Reuter, who became my mentor.
Okay.
This is in Columbus, Ohio. Columbus has an incredible jazz community, amazing musicians there. And initially, the musicians that I found I had most in common with weren't necessarily people studying classical music, but people who are improvisers.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this kind of odd education where I was studying 20th century composition and Tone Rose and electronics and people like that. But I was hanging out with guys who were like really, really digging into jazz and all eras of jazz music. And this was music that I had some knowledge of. I listened to just about everything as a kid, but they were listening to it on a whole other level. And that in turn informed my music as a composer and continues to do so today. I'm not a jazz composer, but I do work with musicians from that world, as well as the worlds of rock and roll, worlds of electronic music. Here in Houston, there's a very healthy, for lack of a better word, noise scene. I mean, that music that, that is just pure noise.
Please explain
branded.
That. What does that
the
mean?
Noise. I've heard about that. What is that?
Noise?
And I don't think it's exclusive to Texas, although I think Texas is definitely a hot spot for that. And I mean, how do I describe it without getting like, you know, I mean, probably a noise musician would just kind of laugh at me if I'm trying to describe it intellectually, but it's music that has a history. A lot of it's very DIY, handmade electronics, very analog. And really is music from the angle of like not chords and melodies, but what goes beyond that, you know. And I mean, there's precedent for this. You can listen to Varese, you can listen to any number of the Futurists, Dadaists, what have you, but this is informed here in Houston, I think, by that a very youthful and very like aggressive kind of energy that you have when you're a teenager and in your 20s, and you need your music to be very confrontational, or what you do to be very aggressive and push back at things that you don't like about the world, right? That's sort of my description. I mean, I'm a musician. I still compose music. I work with a lot of different genres, classical. I write a lot for dance as well, which I really love, and video, like we discussed.
So. And you also were involved in a podcast, a radio show?
It's not on the air anymore. We out of K-TRU here in Houston, we had a show called Composer Talk, myself and a wonderful pianist named Shindong Sai. And once a month, we get on the air and play what we were listening to for each other, which new CDs we got in mail and things we were just exploring. So I miss that. I miss the radio show, but our schedules got to a point where we just couldn't continue doing it. And I feel guilty now. I feel like I need to go back and do that at some point. Radio is crucial. You know, it was crucial to my upbringing. You know, Sunday night before school was when, you know, okay, you're going to bed now, right? Lights went out. I put on the headphones and turned on FM radio. And, and it was like, you know, 2 a.m. until I fell asleep, because that's when they played all the neat stuff.
Right.
You know, they played all the, you know, for me anyway. And, you know, so independent radio stations like WBAI, you know, this is vital. Podcasts are cool. But the live thing and the community-centric thing is something that you just, you can't replace it, thank goodness. And it should still be there, in my opinion, you know.
Yeah, you're talking about after hours and when they started playing things. That's when they break out the album cuts.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, well, we don't know what this is, but we're going to play the whole side of it if you want.
Exactly.
King Crimson. And I'd be like, yes. You know,
yes.
Man, or jazz, you know. They'd be like, well, this is our, you know, the jazz hour. And then they'd play, like, an instrumental Santana cut, you know. But, I mean, this was my musical, part of my education as a young man. And also reading interviews, you know, going back to the book here. But I grew up with magazines like Musician Magazine, Rolling Stone, definitely. And the Q&A format, to me, especially as a young musician, was, I just found it fascinating and very inspiring. And I hope the book, that's one of the purposes I hope the book is able to serve, is that a young musician will pick it up, open it up, and start reading about, like, yeah, I just wanted to get on the bus and go on tour, you know, even though my parents said, you know, do you really want to do this? I told them yes. You know, like, things like that, just these quotes that stick with you. You know, I read about Terry Lynn Carrington when I was 10, and that inspired me to start playing the drums and that sort of thing. That Q&A, that dialogue to me was very important growing up. I learned a lot about music as a young man, and I wasn't even aware I was learning as much as I was. Thank you.
you know I'll leave you.
Well, the thing that I was really happy about, well, that gave me a sense of pride, the amount of former Sugar guests you had in this book. Dee Dee Bridgewater, Terry Lynn Carrington, Brandy Younger, Carmen Lundy, Diane Shore in particular, as a matter of fact. I think I passed on Mary Ann Topper's information to you.
Absolutely. And Diane was here in town recently. I got to finally meet her and give her a big hug in person.
Oh, that's great.
And, yeah, she tore it up. She sounds great.
She just gets better and better. You know what I wish she'd do more of? Play piano, you know, on
piano.
There's like one recording of her doing it, and she does a Bill Evans cut. She's a great pianist.
played with a Houston big band here in town, and they killed it. They were playing Count Basie arrangements, nice. You know, Maynard Ferguson, like really hard stuff, and they just, she sounded fantastic. She opened up by playing the piano, of course, and then she took the stage and had the mic in her water and just, you know, played. We lost count of how many songs she sang. It was, wow. A very generous performance, yeah.
And you have Maz whipping Neoka Workman.
Yeah, love Maz. I love Neoka.
Yeah, and now, how did you, I guess Flip turned you on to Maz as well.
Yeah, and Neoka, I honestly don't remember how we connected, and she's one of the first people I interviewed for the book, and that was a conversation where afterwards I got a really nice note from her saying I felt like I was talking to a friend not an interviewer, and that to me was very, it was really nice to hear that at that stage of the project. It's kind of like, okay, whatever technique I'm using here is working, you know, like be yourself, you know,
right.
I guess that was the message, really. It's like, you know, you're not Charlie Rose, you don't have to be Dick Cavett, or, you know, just don't worry about how the right way to do it. Do it whatever feels natural and whatever's working. If the person does open up and talk, you're doing something right. But I think what Neoka does is really, and Maz too, I mean, it's a great description, you know, of where this music is now and how it's almost impossible to kind of like put a label on things these days. Maz is quite amazing. I can't wait to meet her in person.
Violinist, by the way.
Yes, violinist, and then Neoka's a cellist.
Cellist,
and,
right.
Some people may know the daughter of the great Reggie Workman.
Exactly.
Maz shares a similar story with more than a few players in that she began as a classical player.
Yes.
You know, very much, very steeped in that world. And she was, in fact, at Juilliard, mm-hmm. you know, on that track, right? You know,
yes.
To be whatever, you know, fifth, sixth, ninth violinist, whatever,
right.
in an orchestra. And she talks very, like, honestly about this decision she made to leave Juilliard. And that's the path that musicians take from the time they first are just hooked on an instrument to where they are, to where they can play professionally, to where they have that level of artistry and experience. No two paths are the same.
Right.
You'll read some of these interviews. The musicians, you know, went to college, then they got their master's. Yeah, I got my PhD. Others didn't go to school. You know, Dee Dee Bridgewater repeatedly tells me in her interview, I never took a lesson. I don't know if this comes across, but it was very much like, look, you
does.
Got it, Chris. You know?
And that's exactly what I was going to mention. That's exactly where I was going. Because there were some moments where, and especially with the exchange with Dee Dee Bridgewater, where it seemed as though you were in shock. It's like, no training. It's like, no training, Chris. It's like, no training.
I was in
no
shock.
Training, Chris.
Actually, although it makes sense now, you know, because when I think of the historical context, and where did you go to study jazz back then? No,
there
were
the
only,
bandstand.
You know, yeah. I mean, like Carmen was one of the, you know, she was in one of the first jazz programs.
Carmen
Ellen Feeling as well.
Yeah,
we have to remember that. And now jazz and academia is big business.
Exactly.
You know, you pay a lot of money to get a degree in whatever, you know. But back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, you know, it was, you know, how did you learn? Well, you had to find a teacher or a mentor,
right.
And then you had to get out there and play
exactly.
in front of people. Yeah.
I mean, I think both Dee Dee Bridgewater and Carmen Lundy had time with Mel Lewis and Thad Jones.
Yeah, I believe so.
Carmen Lundy apparently took her music to them and like, here's my music. You want to play it? You know? It was like she just was out there, bold about it.
This is a great composer. You know, this is somebody who's got a whole book of work. You know,
the
Great American Songbook, you know, comes up in a few conversations. And, you know, and that's one of those things that I try and define in the book and explain that, because somebody who's not familiar with that term may say, what the hell is that? You know, and what is the Great American Songbook? Well, you know, Carmen Lundy has composed an incredible amount of different composition. And it doesn't surprise me that she became so immersed and is such a scholar of Mary Lou Williams.
Yes.
You know, another great composer, you know, whose range as a composer, I think people are still kind of wrapping their heads around and saying, wait a minute, she did that and then she did this. So we can't put them in the women box, you know, they wrote a few cute tunes and that's it. You know, it's like, no, you're talking about a major, major composer here. And this is work you should be studied, you know, and it will be. And it is, you know.
And a lot of the progenitors of bebop were at the feet of Mary Lou Williams.
Yeah, you had that great interview interview with the author of Harlem Nocturne on your show.
Jasmine Griffin.
Yeah. And that's, I remember when she talked about that, you talk about shock. I had no idea that she, not only had these, you know, all these incredible musicians had been a part of a salon, essentially, you know, visiting, but also, again, we were talking about how she nursed musicians who were undergoing withdrawal from drugs.
Right.
I had no idea about that either. So, again, this is a major figure that people should, I think, should be at the tip of somebody's tongue, along with the Miles Davis, the Charlie Parkers, you know, the Thelonious Monks, you know, and Marilyn Williams, she should be there as well.
Indeed. I like the fact that you gave section in the introduction to Mary Lou Williams, necessary.
Yeah.
Just so you know, that's not the only part of the book that I read.
I know your standards are very, as a fan and a scholar of literature and music and politics, you know, so I mean, these what you're saying to me really means a lot to me. I mean, I'm not like, yeah, thanks, but I mean, that's deep coming from you, so.
Oh, that's really kind of you. It's like, scholar, I'm a fan.
Well, you know, I have friends emailing me going, you wrote an effing book, man. You know, it's like, you know so I'm not going to be on the faculty of any school anytime soon. I actually don't have a college degree. I don't care. You can put that on the radio. I went 3.5 years to the conservatory and then kind of went on a different journey. Right. And that's another interview.
Right. You're along the line of Mass Swift. You just didn't go to Juilliard. That's it.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I have friends who are in academia and friends who are well outside of it, you know, and I realize now that that serves you well when you're having conversations and when you're interviewing people in a professional situation, you know, you're able to maybe connect. I told each musician, look, you can talk as deeply as you want about music.
Mm-hmm.
I go, don't feel you have to dumb it down. I'm a musician. I have a background in this. We are writing the book so non-musicians can read it. And I think after a while, you know, they also felt comfortable talking about something like, yeah, I left Juilliard and then I went on this journey to, I joined a commune and then I did, things like that, you know. I'm very proud of that, that I was able to, I guess, create that kind of trust, you know, from the people, because the book wouldn't have worked otherwise. If people didn't trust me, then the interviews wouldn't have been very interesting.
And I also think a lot of that trust came from something that I feel throughout the interviews, you allowed them voice. You're not constantly interrupting them to talk about your experience with, you know, Joe Schmo. You know?
Listening, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I do ramble a bit when I'm interviewing people, and I know this from listening back to these interviews, and there were times where I'd be very self-critical, but I would make little notes to myself, you know, check yourself, don't talk, just try and leave some space there, and you may hear something, too. You know this as an interviewer. A person may say something, you're like, so you scribble that down and go, I need to pick up on that. You know, we need to go back to that. Yeah. You know, there's an art to it. The initial interviews I did were very, in some ways, very easy because I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, I did, but because it was new. And then I found towards the end of the project, there was a little bit of self-consciousness kind of stepped in, kind of, I think, made things a little more challenging. And that was me kind of saying, okay, all this other stuff turned out so great. How do I make sure that, you know, but you work through it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And again, yeah, I talk to very generous people. The musicians here, they're cool, you know.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And they were very happy to talk about music. They're very happy to talk about that. How do I put this? Each interviewee thanked me at the end of the interview and saying, thank you. Those were great questions, you know. And there were questions I stayed away from, you know. I mean, I didn't want to get sensationalized. I didn't want to gossip. I didn't want to focus on, you know, what's it like being a woman in jazz? You know, like just something that was dopey and that you see in magazines like Downbeat.
Right.
And you know, right, it's inevitable. Any woman, you know, they talk about their pregnancies. You know, it's like, with a man, they don't talk about insemination. It's just some dude, right? You know, he might have a kid. Who knows? I wasn't conscious of that. And I wasn't interested in that stuff anyway. To me, it was like, let's talk about music. I want a musician to open this book and go, oh, wow, that's how Maz did it. You know, or that's how Connie Crothers did it.
Right.
Or, wow, that's how Jane Monheit, you know, did it. You know, that's what I want. Give them information that's helpful, you know, and inspiring and interesting.
And I like how, because the varied voices that are in this book, the generations, just the newness of people. I mean, there are names, of course, I don't know everybody, but there are names of folks who have been around, like, was it Jan Leder?
Mm-hmm. Jan Leder, yeah.
Jan Leder.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of her hanging out in Central Park in 1975. You know, it's like, I've been at those things with the drummers.
A bunch of hippies.
Yeah, just hanging out in the park making music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Which then takes me to, where did you get these photos? And how did you decide what you would include?
Initially, I thought I would only be able to get a handful of photos from everyone because, honestly, at that stage of the project, my funds were pretty much depleted from designer and copy editing funds, which I caught a break on those. months, but I knew I could get some photos from the folks where I didn't have to go through the manager or the label. And in some cases, the label was very generous, but the budget for a photo, for each photo you see in a book can be, you know, between $500 and $1,000, right. You know, even higher, you know. And I just didn't have that kind of money, especially for photos of 37 different musicians. I felt it was really important to have a photo of each musician, if possible, so that when somebody opened the book, before they even read it, the face of jazz is different colors, different right. ages, different hairstyles, different, you know, clothing, different mm-hmm. instruments. Like, I felt like that would be very powerful if we could pull that off. So I went to each musician one at a time. I talked to a lot of individual photographers, explained how I was self-publishing the book. I don't like asking for photos for free. In some cases, I put together agreements with the photographers, you know, just so they knew I wasn't hustling them. Eventually, we had people donate. Basically, what they did is each person donated a photo. That is overwhelming to me, and I think adds to the power of the book. That photo of Jan, there's also a photo of Cheryl Cassidy when mm-hmm. she's a good Lord, she's a teenager, and she's with like a couple,
right.
couple friends,
friends
three,
yeah.
you know, three friends, yeah, two guys like goofing off like teenage right. boys do, you know, when they get their picture taken, and she's smiling, holding her saxophone, and
right.
has this great, you know, you can tell how happy she is, you know.
Sure.
It's wonderful to have here and there, you know, sprinkled throughout the book, some photos of childhood and that sort of thing. But again, the idea here was to change the conversation. What's your visual image of jazz? Well, for a lot of people, it's a guy in an Armani suit with a trumpet in the shadows, you know.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. Those are beautiful photographs. But if that's your only image of jazz, then I kind of say, well, let's open your viewfinder up a little bit. I hope the photos do that. And again, I have to give credit to the people who took these photographs because they were very generous and behind the project, you know. Everybody kind of rallied around and said, this is important. We want to make it happen. We want to see this. You know, we understand your vision and we want to see it happen. Thank you.
What is the something that you want people to take away from picking up this book?
For a person who is not a musician, but a fan of the music or just curious about the music, that they come away with an understanding of the work and the sacrifice involved in being able to play music at this level. Not so that they feel guilty about music, you know, but that they are able to understand that that job is the same as any other job out there that you have to go to school for, that you have to study for, that you get paid to do, you know, whether it be the person who comes and fixes your bathtub drain, to the guy who works on your car, to a lawyer, great football player, what have you. That's the thing. We're seeing music devalued now, and not just music, but that music is made by people who play, and that kind of makes me nervous. And really, it's just ignorance. You know, people, they may not know a musician, and they just haven't been around somebody who's spent 10, 20, 30, 40 years playing the saxophone every day. Jason Moran was in town recently. One of the wonderful things he said at a talk over at the Contemporary Museum of Arts was that for too many people, jazz, their first experience with jazz is jazz being played very badly. You know, like maybe they see the Ken Burns documentary and they go, well, I'm going to go out and hear some jazz. And they go to a local club or whatever, you know. And they hear maybe Autumn Leaves played where everybody solos and all the musicians are pissed off and, you know, and can't really hear them. And you're just like, well, that sucks. And that's jazz. You have to put a little more time into it than that, I understand. But I want people to come to the music and realize, oh, what I thought jazz was is actually this, Connie Crothers. Oh, wow, it's Maz Swift. Oh, wait, Jay Monheit, too. Wait, mm-hmm. Mindy Abel, you know, and that there's this smorgasbord. There's all of this you can dive into. There's
I like smorgasbord because that's
okay,
pretty much my feeling of all of the artists that are in this book. It's like, oh, my goodness, there's so many people I have to look into now,
yeah.
It's like, which is really great.
Folks at your local level, I mean, I definitely don't want to knock local music at all, you know. I mean, like the musicians, this book isn't just a collection of like, here's the most famous people in jazz. It's not. It's a cross-section of the people next door,
mm-hmm.
you know, as well as, you know, the person who's touring around the world and on TV and stuff. And to me, I wanted to bring all of that back down to earth, too, and say, hey, you know, what makes a great musician isn't whether or not they're famous, you know, or whether or not you see them on TV. It's something else, you know, great musicianship and people who can move you. It might be the person in the club down the street, you know, go down there and check them out, or that festival that you keep saying you're going to go to, but you haven't gone to. Go check that out and just listen. You don't have to have a degree. You know, you don't have to read my book, but you don't have to read a bunch of books. You know, you just go and listen. We all have ears. Just let it go through you and see what happens.
Chris Becker,
yes.
The author of Freedom of Expression, Interviews with Women in Jazz. Did you have a fanboy moment when you were interviewing? Because I know I have many fangirl moments when I'm talking to folk.
Oh, man. Okay, Diane Schur, for some reason, yeah. That was the one where I don't know. I just, some musicians just kind of like, it is kind of that fanboy thing where you're just like, oh, my God, it's Diane Schur.
Exactly.
You know, so there was a little bit of that. I do want to, but, you know, we mentioned Terry Lynn Carrington, of course, and her interview, Ellington quote, which inspired the book's title. When I phoned Terry Lynn Carrington, she's one of the first people I interviewed for the book. So, you know, I was excited, and when I called her, she, I don't know if she'll remember this, but she did not have this on her schedule. Apparently, it wasn't communicated to her that Chris Becker would be calling her at this time to interview her. Terry said, okay, can you call me back? I explained who I was, and I had a reference, you know. And she said, can you call me in 30 minutes? I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And I hung up and called back. She's like, Chris, I'm so sorry. I'm at home. My air conditioning's out. It was one of these days in New York where it was like 200 degrees. And she's like, I'm waiting for someone. Can you call me back in 20 minutes? I'm like, yeah, sure. And by then I'm thinking, well, this ain't going to work, right? Called her again. You know, she's like, okay. And she then sat down and spent about, you know, 45 minutes on the phone with me for that interview, you know. And I mean, who does that? She's Terry Lynn Carrington.
She does that.
She's cool. Yeah. That was real, really cool. It wasn't like, you know, why are you bothering me? I don't know who Chris Becker is. Are you, you know, get out of here. You know, it was the complete opposite, you know. Yeah. So, yeah, that fanboy thing, you know, sometimes it's there, but very quickly it would kind of go away once the questions were being answered and people were talking about the things that they love, you
right.
know, and be it their childhood, be it their family, what they think jazz even is, you know. Yeah, things got easier, I suppose. But, yeah, Diane Schur, she was in town recently. It meant a lot to me that she called me up like the week she was coming into town. She said, I want to make sure that you're there. I want to say hi. I want you to sign a book, even though I can't read it, but I want you to sign a copy of the book. And I'm
nice.
Like, you know, I'm there, Diane. So that was really wonderful. Yeah. If I come up there, you'll be one of the first people I tell, believe me.
Okay.
And I would love to do a reading that's accompanied by music. Like, do it like Jack Kerouac and Steve Allen, only
right.
it would be like Chris Becker and Naz Swift.
Okay.
Or Chris Becker and Roberta Paquette and Billy Mintz on bongos. Or something.
Wow.
So I do want to make that happen.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I think the book has a long shelf life, haha, which means I don't necessarily have to rush up there. Interest in the book will continue. So if I can't make it up in the spring, maybe in the wintertime, you know, and then we have a stack of books and we do a house party and just, you know, again, just kind of keep getting it out there and keep the dialogue happening. And I get to meet more people that I only know by phone, you know. Some of these folks I just talked to on the phone. I didn't talk to them in person. So I would like to make that happen.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. Chris Becker for joining Sugar My Bowl. I'm so glad we were able to do this.
Me too.
And lots of success with Freedom of Expression, interviews with women in jazz, and we look forward to having you visit New York when you can.
Indeed. The book is available at McNally Jackson Books, and it's also available at Blue Stockings.
Well, super cool. I can't tell you how much I appreciate having had this chat with you, and this has been so fabulous talking about this book with you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Joyce, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you and what you do, and your work, so that means a lot to me. Right on. Thank you so much. Appreciate
all
it.
All the best to Lainey as well.
I'll give her your best. You do.
All right.
Take care.
Peace.
And you're listening to the closing moments of Sugar in My Bowl. What you're listening to in the background is Uncle Arthur from the Fiery String Company. That's Nyoka Workman's group. And that release is titled Songbook 1, The Blues Series. Before that, we heard Diane Schur's version of Nardis from Music Is My Life. And before that, we heard One Fine Thing from Dee Dee Bridgewater. That's from Dee Dee's Feathers. That's Dee Dee Bridgewater with the New Orleans trumpeter Irvin Mayfield and the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra. And before that, we heard Money Jungle from Terry Lynn Carrington. That's Terry Lynn Carrington's Money Jungle, Provocative in Blue. And before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. You can try to check to see if the tickets are still available for the Schomburg. The Women in Jazz Festival tickets for the 28th, actually, it's Toshi Regan and her mother, Bernice Johnson Regan, and the focus is Bernice Johnson Regan's compositions. So you can email us at sugar@gmail.com. That's sugar@gmail.com. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa coming up next on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much, Chris Becker. Good night.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.